And welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us here on the program. I always enjoy having you with us as we dive into a subject that I think will give you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Today's going to be no exception to that that rule, if you will. We come your way Sundays at 7 a.m., 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., streaming live at richarddugan.com. The radio show's page is where we put the podcast, as well as on SoundCloud, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and we're trying to expand that as well. And we hope that you will avail yourselves of those podcasts, because the radio program is usually less than the entire interview. We go on beyond that 50 minutes that we are allocated for radio time to continue talking to our guests at their behest in terms of their availability, really. So we hope that you will get those podcasts, listen to them, maybe subscribe to them as well. And if you're listening to the SoundCloud podcast, you see a little grocery cart in the upper right-hand corner as you're listening to that interview. That's a link to the guest's website. Go there. Continue your evolutionary process. Continue your education, your inspiration, the encouragement that they have to offer you, the different ideas that they have to offer. It may not all resonate with you, but there might be little bits and pieces that will help you to continue moving forward. And speaking of moving forward, if you resonate, if what we're doing resonates with you, if you enjoy what we're doing, if you enjoy what we're bringing to the airwaves and to the internet and to you, then please, if you can, support us. We have a podcast, a PayPal account that you can definitely support us through. It is not, I repeat, not tax deductible. We are not a nonprofit, but we certainly will appreciate all the support that you can give us. So we'll take energetic support as well. So we thank you for that in advance, and we are greatly appreciative of all those who have supported us up to this point in the past few years. I think you're going to enjoy today's program, especially considering the fact that, you know, a lot of us are often told that, you know, it's just going to take a long time. You got to go the long way. You've got to traverse it. It's never the destination. It's the journey. We're told this over and over again. Well, our program today is going to be dealing with shortcuts. Yes, indeedy. You know that on your computer's keyboard, if you're a PC person, you have Control-Z, Control-X, Control-C, Control-V. Each one of those is a shortcut to carry out a particular task on your computer. Well, we're going to kind of do that today with our guest. I'm very excited to have with us on the program Tal Ben-Shahar, and he is with us to talk about shortcuts to happiness, life-changing lessons from my barber. Now, Tal, I have to tell you that I must do a shout-out to my barber, Drake, at Victorian Salon, who trims my beard every 2 weeks, whether it needs it or not, and it usually does. And we have some very interesting conversations. It sounds to me like you've had some very interesting conversations with your barber as well. Sounds like he's more than just a barber.
Very much so. You know, I remember when I decided to write about him, I was about to embark on a long flight, you know, go give a lecture somewhere. And I was tired, exhausted, and really didn't feel like getting on that flight, but I needed a haircut. So I went to Avi, my barber, and 20 minutes later, I came out with a haircut and feeling so much better. And not just because it was a good haircut, because he actually helped me feel better. And I thought, I have to write about this guy, because I wasn't the only one benefiting from his wisdom. And, you know, and for years, I've been in academia studying with leading researchers, professors in the area of happiness. And here I was getting so much and maybe so much more from my barber. So I decided to write a book, and I didn't tell him about it because I wanted him to continue being real, authentic himself, which he was.
Now, did you, in essence, do this all from memory? Did you surreptitiously record the conversations? How were you able to maintain, shall we say, the meat of what he was giving you, or the diamonds, if you will, the jewels that he was sharing.
You know, as an author, you know, I've written multiple books, and I always walk around with my notebook, so he always sees me with my notebook, and I'm always taking notes. So it wasn't unusual when he would say something, and suddenly I took out my notebook and wrote what he didn't know that I wrote verbatim what he said. And later transcribed it and reflected on it.
So, when did this all start? I mean, let me rephrase that question. How much time did you spend in the barber's chair? How many weeks, months, years, compiling all this wonderful information? And obviously he knows now, so, you know, you've kind of changed the dynamic a little bit. But over what period of time were you collecting all these jewels?
Well, so I started in March 2014, and I thought, you know, it would be nice to do it for a year and then put it together, and then, of course, ask for his permission to publish it. But after a year, I felt like every time I was going there, I was getting more and more stuff. So I postponed it by another year. So it was 2 years before, on the day, by the way, on the day, 2 years hence, I told him that what I'd been doing.
You talk about some very interesting topics in your book, and one of them, I find this interesting, the way this is phrased. I want to dive into this one here. And I realize that it is your barber's wisdom, Avi. But obviously you have, I would assume you've kind of put your twist on it, if you will, or your understanding maybe of this. But the first one I want to talk about here, and this word is used to describe the main purpose, for example, for sales, in that salesperson's perspective, you must be about the process of creating and developing relationships. A sales call is not about getting them to sign on the dotted line and getting a check. The sales call is about establishing relationships. But you talk about relationships as being the number one predictor of happiness.
Yeah, you know, so every conversation that we had, and which I wrote about later, I obviously brought myself into it as well, specifically from the context of being an academic who studies happiness. So, you know, I would write about the research, or maybe I would write about a philosopher who had spoken about something that Avi said. So when it comes to relationships, Avi always emphasizes relationships, and I need to emphasize real relationships as opposed to virtual relationships. So, you know, when we go into his barber shop, phones are off. You know, people are interacting, whether you're on the, you know, on the hot seat, or whether you're, you know, waiting on the couch next to it. Phones are off, and there are conversations. There are real conversations, intimate conversations. And now he emphasizes it, and he didn't read the research before. Now, I know the research that tells us that the number one predictor of happiness is relationships, real relationships, not 1,000 friends on social media. It's that one best friend that you spend time with. You look at the happiest countries in the world, and unfortunately, the U.S. is not among them. So countries like Denmark and Colombia and Costa Rica and Australia and Israel, why are these countries happier than the United States, despite having their fair share of problems? And the answer is because in these countries, relationships are a priority. People spend time with their loved ones. You know, there's a very famous study that was recently published by Harvard that followed Harvard graduates as well as community members from around the Cambridge area, followed them for 75 years. And after 75 years, it found that the number one predictor of both happiness as well as health, physical health, number one predictor, relationships. Mm-hmm. Now, it didn't matter which relationships. It could be a romantic relationships. It could be work relationships. It could be friendships. It could be family. It didn't matter. But people for whom relationships was a priority, who spend real time with real people.
Well, I would tend to agree. I think that my life has, I mean, I have filled my life with people. Throughout my scant 50, almost 59 years of existence, as I began to grow, I have always, and part of the reason I do these programs, wanted to connect with people, to ask all kinds of questions. And it took me a number of years to learn that I need to rearrange the dimensions of listening to more listening, less talking. And when I finally got that message, the interviews that I have been doing over the last 40 years have gone in directions I never, nor the guest, would have thought would go. Just absolutely astounding, the information, the insight, the inspiration, the touching stories, and so forth. It just incredible. So, you know, that's, to me, relationships are a wonderful thing. I'm not sure if this is true or not. You can correct me if I'm wrong because, well, you wrote the book. But the one I want, I'm not sure if, do we call these chapters? Do we just call these passages? But needless to say, the one on silence seems to be the shortest. And maybe appropriately so. And I have to say that my last trip to the barber, I actually just closed my eyes. And because he was working primarily around my mustache and my chin and so forth, I decided I wasn't going to talk, and neither did he. And again, it's like you talk about in this particular particular tome, if you will, or section, the sound of the scissors cutting through hair and air, the monotonous buzz of the shaver, evening the field with inhuman precision, the sharp razor's crackling sound and point competent, careful hands leaving smooth skin in its wake. Much beauty resides in emptiness. Much growth emerges from silence. Talk to us about those silent moments. Were there a lot of them?
I don't think there were a lot of them, but when they existed, they were meaningful. You know, as teachers often talk about pregnant silence. Mm-hmm. And pregnant silence because just as in pregnancy, there is growth, there is development of something new and something beautiful. And I found that happening because, you know, whether it was because of the, you know, sense that what you need is just to be in silence or just because there was, you know, nothing in particular to talk about, we were silent and it wasn't awkward silence. It was pregnant silent. You know, it reminds me, one of my favorite authors is Robert M. Pirsig, who wrote the book Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Hmm. In his second book, which is Lila, he compares between the Western culture and the Native American culture. One of the main differences that he talks about is our relationship to silence. So whereas in the West, we're mostly embarrassed by silence. We think it's a sign that, you know, there's no interest or no connection. In Native American culture, silence is present. It's real. It's even celebrated. So they could sit around the fire for 2 hours and be silent and just once in a while, you know, lift their gaze and acknowledge one another. Or not, but just be. And having this level of comfort in silence is so important and valuable. And it's valuable for creativity, for growth, and for happiness. You know, Blaise Pascal, the French philosopher, once said that our inability to experience happiness is related to our inability to be in solitude in our room. So the ability, To put it conversely, our ability to be in silence and in solitude is critical for not just creativity, but also for our happiness.
It sounds to me like, I make this comparison, and I think it's apropos to, as you described it, silence in our lives is just as important as getting those 8 hours of sleep. I don't know where you are living out there on the East Coast, specifically what environment you have, but I am lucky enough, having moved from Phoenix, Arizona, the 15th, oh, was it? Well, it was at the time I left, it was the 15th largest broadcast market, you know, pretty profound in that regard. And I moved to Santa Barbara, which I found out was like 280th or something like that. So I moved to a much smaller market from that standpoint, also population wise. But I live up in the mountains above the Santa Barbara area. And certainly we have our challenges. But one of the things that has really struck me is the time between cars going by on the highway 154 that passes down below us, because we live up above the roadway, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 feet, and then back away maybe 200, 300, 400 feet. Is the sounds. It is said that when you hear frogs croaking out in the wilderness, that's a good sign. Well, this winter, we're hearing the frogs croaking, primarily because of all the wonderful rain that we've been getting, too. But it's like, oh, and you just sit there and you just listen. And when the rains are falling, even when it was just a torrential downpour, and we don't have a tin roof, so that was just fine. But it was wonderful. I wasn't worried about being washed away or flooded out, or I was just enjoying that wonderful sound. Not because it hadn't been around for long, just because it was a wonderful sound. And we miss so much when we aren't silent, whether it's in a closet somewhere or a room. Maybe we've sort of soundproofed it. I happen to have a sound booth in my home, in my studio. But it's not 100% soundproof, but it's not bad. But tell us about some of your experiences, not just in the silence, but maybe out in nature when you are silent.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, silence is unfortunately a rare commodity in today's world. You know, if you live in a big city, and I live in New York City, then there isn't much silence to go around. And we pay a price for it. You know, we pay a price in terms of our mental health as well as our physical health. You know, there's a lot of research coming out now on the importance of spending time in nature. And, you know, when you spend time in nature, you're naturally more silent. You're listening more. And there's a lot of value there. And interestingly, also in the field of psychology, of therapy, why is there so much silence in therapy? Because in silence we grow, and when the therapist is able to really listen and to give space, then growth occurs. When we listen, we also grow. When we're silent, we also grow, and there is this self-reinforcing loop, a cycle of growth between the listener and the listened and the the energy that, or the fuel of that growth, is the silence. You know, Mozart once said that what matters more in a piece of music is the silence between the notes. So much happens in the silence between the notes. So much happens
that, yes.
In life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think about it in the context of children growing up today, and not just children. We're addicted to technology, and the reason we're addicted to technology, both the reason as well as the outcome of it, is that we don't have silence. Every moment needs to be filled up with something, with an external and often loud stimuli. So we are. We're constantly bombarded by these. I have a close friend of mine who's a child psychologist, and when her children come to her and say, "But mommy, we're bored," because she limits screen time, and the kids come in and say, "Mommy, we're bored," and she said, "That's okay, sweetheart. Just be bored with dignity." and that's very important for all of us to keep this in mind. You know, being silent, you know, there's something dignified about being in silence, just listening or doing nothing.
Well, you know, I'm sure you are aware, at least, that in my industry, silence is a death knell.
Yes.
And I say this tongue in cheek, that whenever there is a long pause somewhere, not necessarily when my guests are thinking of an answer to the question that I've asked them, but just a tongue in cheek, I say that the previous silence has been brought to you by your local deaf community, you know. it's one of those things where, you know, you're absolutely right when it comes to silence and that aspect of dignity and as well. Outside of broadcasting, it's okay. Sometimes when you are sitting with someone, maybe it's in an intimate relationship and you're just sitting across the table from one another and you are just looking at the other person. And after a while, that person might become a little uncomfortable. Then start questioning, why are you looking at me? What's wrong? I'm just admiring the view, you know, or what have you, to try to say, hey, I'm not, there's nothing nefarious going on here, okay? I'm taking you in, as it were. I love the word from A Stranger in a Strange Land. I am grokking you. I'm trying to assimilate you into every cell, every atom of my being, you know, and so forth and so on. This is fascinating. We're talking today with Tal Ben-Shahar. He is the author of Shortcuts to Happiness, Life-Changing Lessons from My Barber. Why? Was it just an inspiration that hit you over the course of time as you were going to the barber? I mean, obviously, the very first visit, you introduced, hi, I'm here for a haircut, and Avi was, I don't know if he was the first person to cut your hair or not, but obviously he was a very significant person that you obviously continued to go back and always ask for him. I always go back to Drake. My barber, by the way, is a young man who is probably in his late 20s, early 30s. He's been cutting hair for a long, long time and he really enjoys it. And he has a shaved head like myself, but he has a long red beard, very sort of bushy, and he keeps it nicely trimmed, but it goes down maybe to mid-chest, you know, and it looks very cool. Now, my beard's nowhere near that long. I like to keep the professorial look. But I'm curious as to the first time maybe that you met, not so much that you got that inspiration, hey, this guy's got some great stuff, I'm going to write a book, but I'm not going to say anything. Mm-hmm. How about that first meeting with Avi?
You know, the first meeting with Avi was, I must say, was a surprise. For me, because when you look at him, he looks like, you know, he's a tough guy. He's, you know, very he's very muscular.
I see the tattoos also.
Tattoos.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I see the tattoos.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, tattoos over his body, and immediately, of course, stereotypes kick in. It's automatic, and then I sit down, and again, initially there is silence, and. And then, you know, he starts asking questions, you know, about what I do. And and when he hears that I'm in the field of self-help and happiness, he said, oh, wow, so am I. And, it was uphill from there. and we talked about it, and he's extremely well-read. Mm. He never completed high school. And yet he's an autodidact. He learns and studies and reads and asks questions. And I was just just this morning I was reading an essay by René Descartes, the considered by many to be the father of modern philosophy. And it's an essay I'd never read before. I mean, I read him in college. I was a philosophy major. But this was a personal essay where he wrote about his personal philosophy and how he learns. And he writes there that most of his learning, the real learning, didn't come from books. Yes, he was well read, and he was fluent in Latin and Greek and the a number of European language, modern European languages, and yet he got most of his learning, he says, from two sources. One is from introspection, so from me search rather than research, from introspection, and two, from conversations. And I was thinking about, you know, as I was reading Descartes this morning, I was thinking this is exactly what Avi does. Yes, he reads books and he is well-read, but most of his learning comes from conversation, from listening, asking questions, and from introspection. He's extremely introspective. Mm-hmm. And I must say I was blown away by his his words and by his wisdom.
You know, it's amazing when we come across people like that. I've been fortunate that I've come across a few. One in particular, a woman many years ago, and she also didn't let me get away with a lot. She called me on my stuff every so often, which was a little frustrating, but, you know, I'm here to learn. So, okay, put down the ego wall and learn. Did he ever do that to you?
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting you say that. So, again, my favorite philosopher, and, you know, I wish he were alive today. I would have, you know, gone to study with him, but it's Ralph Waldo Emerson. You know, considered by many the American philosopher. You know, so in his essay on friendship, Ralph Waldo Emerson writes, "In a friend, what I'm looking for is not a mush of concessions, a person who will agree with everything that I say. Rather, in a friend, I'm looking for a beautiful enemy, a person who will challenge me and help me in my apprenticeship to the truth." And, you know, when you were describing your friend who called you out on things, you were describing a beautiful enemy. You know, someone whom you who obviously cared about you enough to hold you accountable, who wanted to help you grow, and someone from whom you did learn and grow. And in the same way, that's what I felt with Avi. He was, still is, a beautiful enemy today to me.
You know, another one of my favorites, along with Pierre Descartes, is a gentleman by the name of Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who came up with the idea of the Omega Point, which was the foundation of a group that I belonged to back in the 90s, along with my first wife. And this was in Phoenix. And, of course, they had workshops all over the country. And then I'm pretty sure it's expanded to worldwide. And it was so incredible to sit, not literally at the feet of this man who never claimed to be the oracle, never claimed to have all the answers. He was searching just like us. And I say the same thing here. I don't have any answers, folks. I'm searching just like you. But hopefully after each one of my interviews, I'm a little wiser. I'm a little more inspired as well and so forth. But I always found the conversations or the dialogue or the presentations that this gentleman, whose name was George Adair, he owned a printing company in Phoenix and then also held these 5-day long intensives, you know, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday night, all day Saturday, all day Sunday. And they were free. There was no charge. You gave what you were led to give. He was very much a believer in the universe providing, in trusting the universe to guide. And there have been others as well. I have a very dear friend as well who was my acting coach. But I met her when I first got into broadcasting in 1979. Gorgeous redhead, married to another gentleman who, as I got to know her, the crush began, and I wanted to get rid of him. but we've become very good friends. She's been a very good teacher. And at one point, I even said to her, "I want to thank you for being my mentor." She says, "But I don't want to be your mentor. Let's just be friends." And I thought that was really interesting because I think from her perspective, and I do understand this, if I make her my mentor, then I'm putting her above myself. And I don't think that she wants that. She wants us to be on an even playing field, so to speak, rather than student teacher, even though she would acknowledge that we're both students, we're both teachers for and of each other. Have you been able to maintain that with Avi, that he's you put your pants on one leg at a time, kind of thing? Or is there a certain level of greater appreciation that you have for him than maybe anybody else? I mean, especially considering the fact that you have this book, Shortcuts to Happiness, that in essence, it's not exactly about him, but it's from him.
Yeah. So, first of all, as I see the book is our creation. We fathered it together. Mm-hmm. And I told him this from the word go. I said this when I asked for his permission, of course, to publish it, which he gladly gave. I told him, this is a co-authored book with all the implications thereof. There's joint ownership of this book, and our friendship, we had an intimate relationship before. We were close friends before I even decided to write the book. But our relationship, I think, has gone to the next level. We're a lot closer now, and I often would ask for his counsel as he would ask for mine, whether it's in business issues or in psychological issues. But Richard, I'm sorry, but I must address one point that
Please.
You brought up before, because mm-hmm. I see such a connection here that you talked about Omega Point.
Yes.
And the Omega Point is it's a very powerful concept, and especially the concept is that it comes from Christ's words, and I'm the Alpha and the Omega, meaning. Mm-hmm. From start to finish, beginning to end. And the Omega Point is about the fact that everything goes towards one final point of oneness, of unification. And, as you were talking about it, I was thinking how appropriate it is for what you're doing, because what you're doing is you're eliciting stories from people. You're about listening and getting people to tell the stories. And for a long time, I've been thinking about stories in the context of psychology. And that in physics, many physicists have looked for the one unified theory of the universe. Einstein talked about it. Mm-hmm. Other modern physicists, ancient physicists, from the Pythagoras, the atomists, have talked about the one unified theory of the universe, and physicists haven't found that one unified theory of the universe. Whether it exists or not, whether it's beyond our capabilities to find it or not, that's a question. But I think that there is a unifying theory of psychology, and the unifying theory of psychology is stories. Because if you think about it, wherever you look in psychology, you find the importance, the centrality of stories. What is therapy about? You go to a therapist and you feel better after in 50 minutes. How? Because you tell your story. You create a coherent story. There's a lot of research on journaling by Jamie Pennebaker and others from the University of Texas. And what Pennebaker and others show is that you feel better after you journal. Why? Because you tell a story as you write down your experiences, whether it's positive or negative experiences. You look at cognitive psychology, memory. What do people remember best? Not statistics, not points, not lists. They remember stories. You look at leaders, the best leaders in the world. They're great storytellers, whether it's the Reagans of the world or the Churchills of the world. Storytellers are the best leaders. Wherever you look, developmentally, you look at children. How do they develop? They develop through stories, by imitating heroes from stories. And you find stories in the best-selling books as well. You know, what is the Bible? The most influential best-selling book in history. It's a collection of stories.
Yeah.
So this, to my mind, is, you know, in many ways, the omega point of my field of psychology is stories. So I find it fascinating that you brought it up here and that you do what you do.
Well, I had a guest on not too long ago who was a poet. I'm not into poetry, or at least that's what I thought. As we started talking, I began to realize, oh, you're deeper into poetry than you realize, because I love music. And many, many songs, especially of the artists that I like, whether I like them or not, they still exist, but that many of the songs, the lyrics, are very poetic. They have that essence of poetry in them. Whether they're telling a story or not. I mean, I love one of my favorite artists, the late Dan Fogelberg, who's got some incredible lyrics in some of his early works. And I have almost all of his albums of the early days, 10 or 15 albums of his. And some of the language that he uses to tell these beautiful, some of them are love stories. If you took the words of you took the music away and you just read it, would just be incredible. In other words, there would be no loss minus the music. And so, you know, here I am doing these programs, and someone said to me as I share what I share, they said, "Well, you know, you tell very good stories too." And I never really thought about that. I never really did. But I know one of the things that I used to do many years ago, and this was, again, one of those learning experiences, was to stay focused, you know, because what I tended to do years ago was I'd start out going in a particular direction telling this story, and then for example, I'm sitting here talking to you about Desjardins, and I'm looking at the Wikipedia page, right, and I'm reading down, da-da-da-da-da-da, and I get to the omega point, and I mention that, and, oh, and by the way, speaking of omega point, and I go off on a tangent, right? And then, of course, the gentleman who founded it, George Adair, and I'm going to go off on that tangent and so forth. And I've learned, okay, if you're going off on a tangent, find a way back to the original path so you don't lose people. And so when we're telling these stories, and I have to say that we did a series several years ago in 2014 on mythology. And I was talking with the gentleman who was co-hosting with me. He is now a PhD in mythology, and I've been with him as he went through that process. It was fascinating conversations we had. We used to talk about these mythological stories, you know, and I would ask him some challenging questions in regards to mythology versus, you know, are these true stories or are these all fiction? And it's like, well, it could be a mixture of both. We really don't know. All we know is, we're looking for the message, the moral of, the, you know, in Aesop's Fables. And the moral of the story is, you know, don't feed the wolf or whatever the case may be. When you were talking with Avi, or when he was talking to you or sharing with you or the conversations that you were having, did you find that at the end of the haircut, that and as you were putting this book together, that maybe each one of these topics was kind of like the moral to the story is silence or relationships or those kinds of things. Did that come across to you in that kind of verbiage or context?
It did, though the message always came like a whisper. It wasn't. He wasn't imposing a message. It was gentle, and it was usually a combination between his words and his deeds. So, for instance, you know, when he would talk about the importance of relationships, I would often observe his behavior. For instance, one of the behaviors that I recount in the book is that, you know, it was the middle of the day. There were me and a few other people were in his salon, and then he gets a phone call from a friend, and I figure out from his responses that his friend was in need, And even though the salon was supposed to remain open for the rest of the day, he closed the salon and went to meet his friend because his friend needed him. So it wasn't just talking, paying lip service to the importance of relationships or friendships. He was living it. I also, you know, got to know a lot about his personal life. You know, when he's with his friends, he's with his friends, and by the same with family. You know, he's an amazing father as well as son and partner.
Now I'm curious, and I'm kind of backtracking a little here. Did you see him more as a sort of a partner? I mean, you said that you two fathered this book. But did you see him more as a brother, you know, in these kinds of dialogues? Is that the kind of relationship that the two of you have developed as brothers?
Yeah. So I think, you know, it's a combination, I guess, between a brother and a learning partner. So, you know, I remember when I was studying for my, you know, school final exams, you know, my closest friend and I would spend a lot of time together, you know, going over the material, and we would test one another. And it made learning better, and better in terms of outcome, and also better in terms of experience. So in this respect, I felt that Avi played that role for me as a person. You know, we learn together. We learn together about the world, and we learn better, and we enjoy the experience more. You know, one indicative fact for me around writing this book. You know, usually when I write books or when I write, period, I wouldn't say stressed, but I'm very grave. You know, serious. You know, I need silence. You know, I don't talk to anyone. If you had looked at me, you know, my face would be, you know, stern even. And, you know, it's a very serious endeavor for me. And yes, you know, I do enjoy it. I love writing, but it's a serious endeavor. Whereas when I was writing this book about Avi and reflecting on what he said, first of all, writing down what he said and then reflecting on what he said, I was constantly smiling. And I can't really explain it. Well, I can try to explain it. And it's the fact that, first of all, he did much of the work for me. I mean, it's not that I had to work hard to come up with ideas. He generated the ideas. And second, it was I brought his spirit to writing. And his spirit is he's a free spirit. You know, he doesn't take life as with such gravitas as I or many other academics do. He takes it much more lightly. He doesn't take himself seriously. And as I said, you know, it's both his words and his behaviors that found their way into the pages of the book, and we were writing it together, even when I was in solitude in my room. Mm-hmm. So his spirit was there, his playfulness was there.
And you still see him on a regular basis for a haircut?
Oh, of course. Yes, I go for haircuts more often than I need to, and my kids go more often than they need to.
Yeah.
You know, whatever excuse I can, I don't need excuses anymore, I guess, but still.
Yeah. Now, have you ever gotten together with him outside of the barbershop? I would assume so, considering the fact that, you know, again, I love the way you phrase this, that the two of you have sort of, you've fathered this particular work. What other times do you spend with him in this kind of collaborative, metaphysical, evolutionary process?
So we do spend time together outside, but, you know, it's always in conversation. So, you know, we would have you know, coffee together and you know, just hang out in the, you know, the local, you know, coffee shop. Nothing beyond that. But over time, you know, I've gotten to know his family better, and he's gotten to know my family better. But our, you know, what we connect over is, you know, the dialogue, that conversation. And interestingly, since the book came out, many more people are joining us in these conversations. So, you know, people would come to me after the book was out. He said, you know, this was exactly my experience. Maybe I'll write the sequel to this, because I have so many stories about him. And now when we talk, people join in, and I love it, because it legitimizes the serious / playful dialogue about serious ideas.
I love it because for two reasons. Number one, if we were to come across the two of you, my wife and I, my present wife and I, were to come across the two of you, my wife would just absolutely dive into the deep end with you, as would I, because she loves those kinds of conversations. But I guarantee you, she is not going to sit there and go, wow, this is great stuff. She would be playing devil's advocate. Because she is
a beautiful enemy.
Yeah, because she is trying to learn to and to understand. One of the most profound, and I want you to address this particular subject, but one of the most difficult conversations for me to have with my present wife is the conversation about death. Now, the reason why it's difficult is because she does not have a belief, let alone a knowing, that there's anything after this life. But then again, who does? Unless you and Avi know something that we don't and would like to share it. And so all I can tell her, the best I can tell her, is this. I don't know, but I believe that there is more after this. And here's the reason why. My logical brain, which was given to me by I don't know who, tells me that my life has meaning, and that this life is not an accident, and that if I did not have that essence of meaning inside me, then I could go out and rape and pillage and plunder, and it wouldn't matter, because this is all an accident, and it doesn't matter. Now, I said that if at the point when my essence leaves this body, this physical material body, and it's lights out, I'm never going to know anyway, so it's not going to make any difference. But what I do know is that I don't live my life with meaning and purpose and try to be kind and, you know, to do unto others, golden rule. I don't live my life hoping that there is an afterlife and that, you know, so I won't get punished. No. I live my life because it's, I don't know, it's the right thing to do, because I'm compelled through that aspect of having meaning in life. And it's like, that's the best I can do. That's the best answer that I can give based upon what I know and what I believe and what I feel inside. What about you and maybe conversations that you've had with Avi in regards to all of this? I mean, it's huge, I understand, but where do we start with this?
Yeah, you know, this is, you know, obviously the question of existence, and many philosophers and psychologists have spoken about it, thought about it, and as you say, you know, there are no definitive answers, and we each need to come up with our own. So let me give you a little bit of my two cents, and Avi and I, you know, have spoken about it, and he certainly helped me. Mm-hmm. Deepen my thinking about it, or my feeling about it. You see, Einstein, at least a quote attributed to Einstein, is the following. He said that there are two ways to live our life. One is as if nothing is a miracle. The other is as if everything is a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really think about it, everything is a miracle. You know, so and Einstein recognized this because, yes, you know, he can come up with formulas to describe reality, you know, whether it's E equals MC squared, or, you know, seek for that unifying theory or unifying formula of the universe, and maybe even find that. But all that does is describe a phenomenon. It doesn't provide you with the understanding of the source of the phenomenon, or with an ability to replicate the phenomenon, to create that phenomenon. So, you know, how can we hear one another right now? You know, that's a miracle. Yeah, we understand airwaves and, you know, sound waves and stuff, radio waves, Wi-Fi, But do we really understand the source of it all? How does life happen? You know, we don't really understand that. We can describe the process, we don't deeply understand it. So if you think about it, you know, there are miracles all around us. We don't need to, see a God coming from heaven and talking to us. You know, seeing a tree grow, that's a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
And in that respect, I find it difficult to fathom the fact that it's all just, you know, random collection of atoms. And, I'm in the minority in the academic world, because most academics would say, yes, you know, evolution explains everything. No, evolution doesn't explain everything. Mm-mm. It explains a very small part of reality. The Big Bang is a description. It's not a deep explanation of how life came into being. So there is more than meets the eye, more than meets the rational mind. And all we get from that miracle are the messages. And what are the messages? The messages are very clearly: be kind, be generous, be good. We have a moral sense. Philosophers talked about it, psychologists are showing it today. We're naturally empathic. And all we have are, you know, these messages that we get from the Creator. And now I'm not talking about the Creator as, you know, a God sitting in heaven and saying, let there be light. What I'm talking about is something that I don't understand, I don't know, but the message is very clear. It's be good, it's be nice, it's giving us the message. You know, you want happiness, create real relationships. You want joy, you know, learn to celebrate silence. And these are the messages that we can find within ourselves, because we have been created by whatever entity it is that created human beings and trees and stones.
Hmm. Tal Ben Shahar is my guest, the author. I suppose I should say the author, ghostwriter as well, for Avi.
Right.
Shortcuts to Happiness, Life-Changing Lessons from My Barber. I am so intrigued by all of this. I mean, this is, and of course, I extend this invitation usually at the end of the program, but I got to tell you, if it were you and or Avi, I would love to just sit down with the two of you. I don't know whether I'd rather listen or participate in the conversation. Because there is just there's just an abundance there, and you spoke of messages. There's an author that I read several of his books when they first came out, and there was a concept within his fictional story that I loved, and we're talking about James Redfield and the Celestine Prophecy, and he talked about how we all have messages for one another. And that we need to share those messages with one another, because in the sharing of those messages, and now I sort of paraphrase and put my own twist on it, it allows us as individuals to continue to put together the puzzle pieces of our understanding of our place in the universe, who we are, why we're here, et cetera, et cetera. And that when we don't, it's the equivalent, and pardon the Star Trek analogy, of putting up the shields. Now, we can fire weapons, okay, but there's no transporting in or out. There is communication, but it's stilted, okay? And so we need to put down the shields, and we need to begin the process of that, you know, of the genuine dialogue with one another to learn something. And in this day and age, it's very difficult, because everybody seems to have a different perspective on what's real, what's true. And again, not getting into anything specific as far as current events, because we don't need to. Everybody is kind of self-aware of that. What is your perspective on, and I guess I should say yours and Avi's perspective, on sharing our point of view in a world where if you share your point of view, you better know your audience, if you will.
Yeah, you know, there's one of my favorite lines ever is actually the title of a lovely book by Wayne Dyer and his daughter Serena Dyer, and it's called "Don't Die with Your Music Still in You." And you know, it's very much related to what you just said about, you know, what is your message? Your message needs to be heard, and how do we tell our message? You know, we tell it through our story. And when we tell it through our story, it's we're not saying this has to be your story. We're just saying this is my story. And if you can get take something from it, it's yours. And if not, then not. And stories are not and don't have to be threatening. Because they're personal. And yet it's very important to share them, even if the audience does not celebrate them or enjoy them as much as we do.
Yeah.
If we are to be beautiful enemies to others, we need to share our story, our message.
Yeah. And unfortunately right now I'd have to say that in many instances we're kind of the ugly. But we can change that. We absolutely can. Because when, you know, and again, this is not so much from a selfish perspective or ego perspective. I want to know. I want to understand. So please give me your message. And then, you know, it's kind of like, you show me yours, I'll show you mine.
Yes, and it's true, because when we do share our story, other people are more inclined to share theirs. They're more likely to open up.
And you and Avi have done that through this wonderful little book. And it is. It's a nice little book. It's almost pocket size. If it were a little smaller, I could stick it. Because I don't have pockets quite that big unless I'm wearing a trench coat. Shortcuts to Happiness, Life-Changing Lessons from my Barber. First of all, before we continue on, what is a website that you would want us to go to so that we can continue to learn not only about these shortcuts, which are actually, they're a lot easier than Control Z, Control C, Control X, but that where they can also learn about you, learn about Avi, and learn about how they can get more involved in this process of, well, if you will, sharing the shortcuts with other people through, because I like the way you put it, through story.
Yes, so I would love it if people would come and visit my website, where I have more information about Avi and his wisdom. Well, as courses and videos and of lectures and so on about living a full and fulfilling life. And the website is my name, www.talbenshahar.com.
All right, folks. And we're going to be linked to that website. And that, once again, is Talbenshahar. That's TalbenShahar.com. And I would like to ask you also, Tal, tell me about how your philosophical view has changed, especially from childhood. Where did you start when you came into this world? And what was it that, as I like to say, what was the catalyst that either continued moving you forward in the same philosophy that you were raised in, or that said, I want more?
Yeah, so, you know, I was raised at a wonderful, wonderful childhood, very supportive family and very supportive community. But I'd always lived under the impression that the key to happiness, the path to happiness, is through success, by doing well. You know, I was an athlete. I played squash. It was by winning squash championships. It was by getting into a top college. It was by getting a good job or making a lot of money. I'd always lived under the impression that that was the path to happiness. And all this changed. It changed in a minute, but it was building up towards that. It changed in a minute when I was a sophomore in college. I was at Harvard studying computer science, and I found myself doing very well academically, doing very well in athletics and sports, doing quite well socially, and yet being very unhappy. And I remember waking up one very cold Boston morning, going to my academic advisor and telling her that I'm switching majors. And she said, "What to?" And I said, "Well, I'm leaving computer science and moving over to philosophy and psychology." And she said, "Why?" And I said, because of two questions. The first question is, why aren't I happy? And the second question is, how can I become happier? And it's these two questions that have that took me on a path that I'm, you know, still on, you know, almost 30 years later.
Hmm. What about your family and friends as you've grown in this? How has that impacted them? Because I've often found that one of the old sayings about you're told this as a kid growing, you can't change people. And I've actually found that's not true. You can. You can't do it consciously. But when you change yourself, you actually do change the people around you. And sometimes you change the people that are around you. So tell us about those experiences.
Yeah, you know, so, you know, the people, I guess, that have always been attracted to me and that I've been attracted to were people who were about, you know, growing and personal development and societal development. So, you know, my wife and I, you know, we always, you know, we joke about it, how we always, you know, dig deep. So, you know, someone would bring up an idea and then we would say, okay, so, you know, what do you mean by that? And we'd go back and forth, you know, being beautiful enemies to one another, and develop and grow as a result, you know, and it's an, you know, for other couples, you know, this would sound, you know, tedious and, you know, and boring, but for us, these are the bricks that make up our relationship. So, you know, and this was the case, you know, while I was studying computer science as well. So it's not just studying philosophy and psychology that brought that out in me. I've always, these are the people that I enjoy hanging out with, being with.
Mm. I have to say that it's been frustrating for me over the years, especially having to move. I moved from Phoenix to Santa Barbara, which was a great move. Don't get me wrong. But I also knew I was leaving a lot of wonderful experiences behind.
Mm.
You know, I was leaving behind a lot of people that I enjoyed communing with and sitting down and having these kinds of conversations.
Mm.
Sadly, they weren't recorded. I would have loved to have used them as well. Some of my favorite times back in the 90s with my first wife, when I was married to my first wife, were when I would attend what were called firesides. And these firesides were put on by, I call them philosophies now, by the philosophy known as the Baha'i faith. And I became a Baha'i for about a year and a half. And I loved going there and talking about so many of not only the ways in which we human beings need to and can interact and relate with one another in such a way to make a better world, but also the more esoteric and spiritual aspects that are taught in this philosophy. And it was just so incredible to, you know, to be a part of that. And over the years, that's what these programs have turned into. The only thing that's missing here is a little campfire in the middle, but I don't think my boss would go for that sitting on the console. In the West, from your perspective, have we lost that ability to sit around the proverbial campfire and talk in these ways? You and I may be coming from totally different perspectives, okay, but somehow, some way, we managed to find a way to relate.
Yeah, You know, I think you're spot on, and it is a lost pastime or a lost art. Just conversing, just sitting around that fireplace or by the fireside, and it's unfortunate because again, one of the topics I spoke to Avi a lot about reminded me very much of what Aristotle used to say. So Aristotle said that the two paths to happiness are friendship and contemplation. In other words, relationships and philosophizing. Now, if you think about it, when you're sitting around that the fire or by the fire, what you're doing is you're doing both. You're enjoying friends and you're philosophizing, contemplation and relationship. So that is something that is lost and it's unfortunate. It's very unfortunate because there are many. You go to restaurants today and you see even couples sitting across from one another and both of them are on their phone.
Mm-hmm.
This is not conversation. This is not intimate conversation. You see kids going out and spending time together, and even when they do spend time together, they're on their phones. And we must, because we're paying a very high price for it, we must regain our ability to have these conversations.
And there's a place out here in California, it's actually east of Santa Barbara, a community called Ojai. And there is a retreat center. It's a foundation. It's actually the Ojai Foundation, where the Joseph Campbell people who are into Joseph Campbell gather. And there's this magnificent, magnificent oak tree. And I believe they call it the thinking tree. But we've only been there once or twice, and we would meet there. We could sit on the roots. I mean, the roots were above ground and, sprawled out, and the top of the tree is just gnarled out and everything. And thank goodness when the fires of 2017, December, rolled through that area, that tree was preserved. But we would meet under that tree, and they would have these lectures, if you will, these presentations about different aspects, not only of Joseph Campbell's teachings, but also of the various philosophies that have existed down through the ages. I think when we were there that one time, they were showing Egyptian art going back thousands of years and the connections to the gods, again, the mythology, the stories, and so forth. And it was just, and it's like, I don't really have that great an interest in Egyptian mythology, but I didn't care. It was one of those things where I didn't care. Being in that environment elicited. And then we went back another time, and of course we went inside one of the yurts, and we had a wonderful conversation about, I forget what the subject was. There's so much that you can be sharing and talking about. But that's one of the things that I've always found so unique, and that's part of what you talk about, and of course one of the main things, and that is establishing relationships. I always had trouble with sales in spite of the fact that, and here's the real irony, I'm really good at sales. I worked for a company here in Santa Barbara when we first moved here. Hated the job. Absolutely loathed it because I hated selling people stuff I didn't think they needed, right? And man, I was really good at it because by the time I left, I was in the premier sales goldfish bowl, if you will, for 3 weeks before I left. And I was making pretty good money, but it wasn't really what I wanted to do. But it's just, it's incredible the things that are out there. And I know that we also could, will you address the aspect of being authentic as well and being our true selves? It's when we're the most content. And you've already addressed that as well in terms of how we can get there.
Yeah. I called the book Shortcuts to Happiness, and obviously it's a name that comes from what Avi does, which is cuts hair. But the shortcut here is understanding it. It's not really applying it is much more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
So you know when you talk about being authentic,
yeah.
Or having these real conversations, we understand it. It's easy, but applying it,
yeah.
That is the challenging part.
Yeah.
That is especially in today's world where you know where things are so fast, when there is so much noise around us.
Yeah.
Being in silence is a challenge.
And by the way, I don't know whether you intended this or not, but I just got a wonderful little metaphor from the title. Because that's exactly what a barber does. He makes short cuts, not long ones, but short little cuts until he gets it. It's kind of like, what was it, Da Vinci? I forget who it was, Da Vinci or some sculptor who was asked when he was looking at this giant piece of marble and says, I'm going to make this particular statue. So, well, how are you going to do that? He says, well, I'm just going to knock away everything that isn't what it is that I want. And kind of a barber does the same kind of...
Michelangelo said that about David.
Yes, okay.
Yeah.
And so a barber kind of does the same kind of thing. He just trims away that which does not look
exactly
like
right.
the... Now, does Avi, and this is going more to a practical aspect, does Avi cut your hair the same way every time, or does he sometimes, has he ever taken liberties and says, you know, why don't you try this style? Because my barber, and I have no problem with this, my barber sometimes will let the beard, he won't trim it as much sometimes, and other times he'll trim it down a little bit more. And I don't mind as long as I have the beard. I do not want to look like one of those guys that hasn't made his decision yet. Should I grow a beard or should I not? I'm going to let it grow a little. And they look so scruffy. And I'm going, make a decision. Grow the beard or don't grow the beard.
Yes, I always leave it up to I leave it to the pros.
Yeah. Well, it's always great to find a good barber. And obviously, Avi is a good barber. You're looking good in your pictures. And I'm sure he's the one that did the hair. Hairstyle by Avi. Yes, indeed. Now I'm curious. Is he just a barber, or is he a stylist?
He's both. That's the thing, that he's always learning. So he started off as a barber, and then he learned styling, and he's learning. Twice a year he's off actually to Italy, to learn the latest and best in styling and in cutting. So.
Well, he and I must have the same barber because we have the same hairstyle. I've had it since 2001, and I like it, but I also did it as solidarity for my wife, who is my second wife, who was going through cancer and chemo treatments, and she's been free and clear of it ever since. So 17 years, 18 years free and clear, and very happy about that. Tal Ben-Shahar is my guest. Shortcuts to happiness, life-changing lessons from my barber. Tal Ben-Shahar, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program. This has been a lot of fun. I have thoroughly enjoyed this. I would like, first of all, to, as I mentioned earlier, extend the invitation. Should you and or Avi be out here in Santa Barbara, I would love, and we'd record it, to sit down and chat more, because there is so much more that we can talk about. We've only scratched the surface.
Indeed. Thank you very much for the invitation, and I will relay it to Avi.
And also reminding our listeners that if you'd like to get more information, and as I said, we will be linked to the website talbenshahar.com. He's also on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, and so you can check him out there. We'll be linked to the website as well. And just a reminder that if you're listening to the radio broadcast, you need to listen to the podcast, because there is a lot more, a whole lot more, and I hope that you will avail yourselves of that. And before I let you go, Tal, I have to ask you three final questions. Again, my thanks for giving us so much time. I know it's precious, but I really do appreciate it. First question is, who is Tal Ben-Shahar?
A student, a journeyer.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Spread happiness around the world.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
Spread happiness throughout the world.
I love it. I love it. Tal, again, thank you so much for joining us here on the program. I really look forward to having you back on. Whether we're in studio or not, I would love to talk to you again and have you back on maybe later in this year.
That would be wonderful. Thank you very much. And thank you for the amazing work that you're doing, helping people get their stories out.
Well, thank you again. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love, Talal.